like to thank Bruce for the opportunity to be back here this year. He gave me this title, and I was very grateful that 2 weeks ago he called me to tell me what it meant. And what we're going to focus on is aligning surgical pathology and informatics to promote patient safety. Last year, I spent quite a bit of time talking about patient safety. We're only going to briefly review a couple of things about safety in surgical pathology so that we can all start from the same platform this morning. I'd like to spend a little time talking in broad terms what informatics' role might be in fashioning solutions to the problem of safety in surgical pathology. But most of our time will be focused here, aligning surgical pathology with informatics resources. I want to talk about it in terms of the principles, and I want to share with you our experience at the University of Michigan. So that's the plan. Let's start with safety in surgical pathology. The medical community became engaged in a big way in the conversation about patient safety in November of 1999 when the Committee on Quality of Healthcare in America published its first quality report, this one called To Err is Human, Building a Safer Health System. And the authors of this report said that their goal was to break the cycle of your and my inaction. They pointed out that there would be no excuses despite the cost pressures, liability constraints, resistance to change, and other seemingly insurmountable barriers, technical or otherwise. It is simply not acceptable for patients to be harmed by the very system supposed to offer healing and comfort. That was followed in short order, March of 2001, by their second report to serve notice that safety would not come at the cost of the other important attributes of quality in healthcare. And they talked about the fact that care should be not only safe, but it must be effective, defined as avoiding underuse and overuse. It must be patient-centered, something that's rather foreign in the world of surgical pathology. It must be timely, also foreign in some practices. It must be efficient and it must be equitable. But our focus today is what it means to be safe in healthcare. And safety in healthcare really means being error-free. There are lots of ways to think about errors in medicine. Lucian Leap categorizes them into four main buckets: errors of diagnosis, errors of treatment, errors of prevention, and another category for miscellaneous categories of error. I suppose pathology could have connections to all four, but I think the two in which we chiefly reside are errors of diagnosis and this important other category. Lucian Leap says errors in diagnosis have multiple faces, multiple facets. There are errors in diagnosis, you got it wrong. But he also highlights, and he's not speaking specifically about pathology, but I think we are the intended recipients, that delays in diagnosis are an equally egregious category of diagnostic error. Making the right diagnosis too late to matter is not safe. Failures to employ indicated tests, if we had only done the right thing, we would have known the answer, is no longer sufficient. Use of tests that are no longer the standard. And failure to act on the results of our testing. There's been an interesting email dialogue between academic leaders of anatomic and surgical pathology about the whole issue of critical values and reporting them in surgical pathology. And the tenor of the correspondence was, this is not our problem. Can you imagine? Alerting physicians to critical values that will affect the lives of their patients is somebody else's problem. We have a lot of work to do. It's easy to shrink away from some of the issues of error and say, but we're only human. And indeed, studies in multiple industries have concluded that when you look at accidents, 60 to 80% linked to our human condition. Anesthesiologists were really the first group in medicine to study errors and error reduction. And in studies performed in the 70s, concluded that intraoperative accidents at the hands of anesthesiologists over 80% of the time were a reflection of the human condition. Informatics can be key to overcoming that reality, something I think very familiar to us. errors have been personal to me for a while. They were personalized further a year ago this month when the Ann Arbor News had this front page. There we were sharing space with the Tigers and the Pistons and drive-by monitors for car exhaust. Our laboratory's failure to accurately identify a specimen was no longer a secret. And they said it was the fault of a laboratory technician, a human error that cost the university $3 million and a lot of public relations. The implication by the reporter was that if we had just had a better technician, this might not have happened. But I have to tell you, it was our best technician. It was a talented technician. It was a bright technician for whom this was so traumatic, she no longer works in healthcare. Humans will fail. We have to figure out ways to avoid that for them and not leave them holding the bag and take no comfort in the fact that they are named and we are not when we reach the front page of the paper. Now, the University of Michigan is not alone. I don't know if you've seen your institution on the front page. Lots of them have gained that notoriety. Last year in October, newspapers, various internet-based news media carried this story of Derry Eason, who discovered only after having her double mastectomy that she never had cancer in the first place, another specimen mix-up. Similar story originated from Minnesota earlier in the 2000s. We've made a lot of popular press. Reader's Digest, August of 2006, the author said in very large font that pathologists are gambling with your life. And they actually told the readers of Reader's Digest about floaters. Can you imagine? We hoped floaters would remain an in-house secret. Now, patients know the many ways in which we can get it wrong. How often does it happen? Hard to say, hard to measure. Depends, again, on how you define error in surgical pathology. If you define it as diagnostic discordance, which is a very insufficient surrogate for error, Andrew Renshaw and many others have shown that it can be as high as 11%, and interestingly, it varies depending on the driver for re-review of a case. But Andy was different from other authors in that he actually linked that diagnostic discordance to the actual patient experience and pointed out that diagnostic discordance does not necessarily identify an error that is meaningful from the patient experience. If you look at historical data that has defined it a little more meaningfully and look at how often we get it wrong in a way that matters, which have historically been referred to as significant errors, meaning that they changed the way the patient might have been managed or the prognosis for the patient's condition, that's more like 1% or less. And it's really these historical numbers in which we found comfort, because historically that's how we thought about quality in surgical pathology. We looked at these numbers and said, well, not so bad. At the University of Michigan, that error rate means 700 sentinel events a year. That will not play well on the front page of the Ann Arbor News. We've got a problem. In thinking about errors, the tendency historically in quality assurance programs in surgical pathology and medicine in general has really been to focus on active errors, those that occur at the level of the frontline operator, because they're easy to identify. Woods and Associates describe that as the sharp end of our complex healthcare system. It's really the interface between the practitioner and our monitoring processes. And therefore, really by design, we focus on the active errors at the hands of the practitioner left holding the bag. I think what we've learned since 1999 is that's really an inappropriate way to look at error in surgical pathology or anything else, where our focus should be on latent errors. Those that tend to be removed from the direct control of the operator, they reflect poor design, poorly structured organizations, and they are much tougher to both measure and resolve than are those frontline mistakes. And I think that's why we've avoided them. Again, Woods and Associates refer to that as the blunt end of the complex healthcare system, and in many respects, that's our topic this morning. How do you organize? How do you develop policies? How do you develop procedures at the blunt end of healthcare delivery that impacts safety? Don Berwick says it this way: quality is an attribute of systems, not people, in medicine, and every system is perfectly designed to achieve exactly the results it gets. That if your error rate today is 0.5%. That's likely what it'll be next year and the year after that, unless you change something. Because you're designed to deliver at that rate. So that's where we were when we were talking about safety a year ago at this conference. We concluded that significant errors occur in anatomic pathology practice at a low but predictable frequency. It's really a consequence of our complex processes that set us up to fail. And we left agreeing that we could do better, but we left this question on the table. How? Which brings us to our second of our three objectives. What does this conversation have to do for informatics? How can informatics play a role in making surgical pathology safer? In its 1999 report, the Institute of Medicine did offer some principles that ought to guide solutions and countermeasures for addressing safety issues in medicine in general, and I would argue they apply to pathology in spades. First is providing leadership. The fact that we're having this conversation at a national meeting says that leadership in the informatics community is ready to play its part. Traditionally, when we talk about informatics and safety, we've kind of focused on this second bullet from the Institute of Medicine, which is we have to learn to respect human limits in process design. If you've got your best tech mixing up specimens, it means there's a problem with the process and not the tech. What are the sorts of things that the Institute of Medicine was talking about? Talking about avoiding reliance on memory, talking about using constraints and forcing functions, talking about avoiding reliance on vigilance, key areas in which informatics solutions have focused. They've also been the key tools historically in our quality assurance programs. If you could just remember to get it right next time, I'll try. If you could just be more vigilant next time and not screw up the specimens, I'll try. The sorts of informatics solutions common to you, and this is just a small list, it could be much larger, things like provider order entry, things like patient specimen identification solutions that are much more robust than what we've had historically, things like standardized workflow driven by computerized workflow models, standardized results reporting, templates that are now common in many practices, and case-appropriate content delivered to the practitioner at the time of sign-out that might inform the final product before it's verified and distributed. Institute of Medicine also said that the fundamentals are to simplify and standardize your processes, again, areas in which informatics can play a key role. These are the other areas that the Institute of Medicine talked about in which it's harder to see the link to informatics, but I would argue that they have everything to do with what you're about. It's about promoting effective team functioning, anticipating the unexpected, and creating a learning environment around the issue of safety and quality. And safety and quality are related no matter how you define quality. Recent data was collected and published that showed one of the distinguishing features of those organizations that had the best safety records in healthcare was that their leadership were focused on service. They are not unrelated. And that's about creating a learning environment where you celebrate errors as opportunities to be better. It's about encouraging the reporting of errors and doing that in an environment in which there are no reprisals. Again, this is an area in which informatics has traditionally had a presence. Thomas and Peterson suggested that if you look at the various ways for measuring error in medicine, some of them get you closer to the blunt end of our complex healthcare system than others, and they put information technology right near the fat part of the triangle. The role of informatics historically has been to do things like identify events, generate reports, and perhaps provide some data analysis. Again, some of the other conversation around creating a learning environment doesn't look like it's linked to informatics, but I'm going to show you how I think it is. They said you have to develop a working culture in which communication flows freely regardless of authority gradients, something that medicine learned from the airlines when they discovered that is fundamental to improving the safety of flight in the 70s. That it was unsafe to fly in a culture where your co-pilot was afraid to tell the pilot that they were going down. Real events. Where the co-pilot was afraid to tell the pilot, did you notice the large 757 at the end of the runway? conversation never occurred, and it was a disaster. And medicine's no different, right? And it's about implementing mechanisms of feedback and learning from our errors. When it comes to this working culture thing, which I think is huge, the perception is that we're not so good, at least from those outside of healthcare. In an interesting survey published several years ago in the New England Journal, Blendon and Associates surveyed over 2,000 respondents, some of whom were physicians and some of whom were non-physician members of the public at large. They asked them about how often they experienced error. It was a high number, 40%. They asked them how often it was serious. It was a high number, 10%. They asked how serious. The answer was pretty serious. We're talking about death here. And when they said, well, what do you think the very important causes of that experience are, the public had as number three on their list, you guys are lousy at teamwork. Failure to work together or communicate as a team. Interestingly, the physician respondents did not quite see it that way. It was much lower on their list, but the public said, from where we sit, you are lousy at teamwork. And so the challenge we're talking about this morning is, how do you create meaningful organizational links to overcome that weakness when thinking about surgical pathology and informatics and how we're going to partner to facilitate innovative solutions around safety? That's what we're here to talk about this morning. And that takes us to our third and final objective. How do you align surgical pathology with informatics resources? First, let's talk about the principle. In my view, there are three imperatives around this alignment. The first is alignment at an organizational and administrative level. Where are you on your organizational chart, if you will? Because that will tell me how you work together. Now, why should that matter? I think it matters because this only can be successful if informatics and the operators in surgical pathology have a common vision and mission rather than visions and missions that overlap or worse are diametrically opposed. They have to have common strategic goals and they have to have a common understanding of operational imperatives. Why? Because that's where you decide to spend your money. Organizational administrative alignment. How does that happen at the University of Michigan? I'm sure there are lots of ways to do this successfully. The way it happens at University of Michigan, I would argue, in a manner that's successful, is that informatics is one of seven co-equal divisions in the department. It's got both clinical and research arms. And Yul Blees is the current director of clinical informatics at the university, his predecessor, of course, being Bruce Friedman. Now, historically, the closest neighbor to informatics, at least in terms of the clinical enterprise, was always clinical pathology. And I think that's because, I don't actually know, but I imagine it's because the rate at which CP created demand with new testing modalities over the last few decades. It really was the primary consumer of informatics resources because they were generating most of the demand. So when you talked about meaningful links at a clinical level between informatics and practitioners of pathology, this was the link that mattered, which results in some odd conversations that actually irritate someone who does what I do for a living. In fact, I'll share with you the number one on my top 10 list of things not to say to people like me when it comes to informatics. And this is something that I commonly hear on site visits when we're trying to imagine what the future of informatics looks like in surgical pathology. Do you know what this is? Do you know what's coming? RLIS was chosen by CP. It actually doesn't work well for us. Really, I mean, that's not foreign, right? Anybody ever heard that before? I mean, I have to tell you, when I hear that, I have a lot of questions about our partnership and what it's been historically. I would also argue that anatomic pathology is creating demand for informatics services that has either overtaken or will soon overtake CP. Why is that? Well, you know much more about that than I do. But it's things like image digitization and its role in future practices. It's about things like new testing and research technologies that actually blur the historical division between surgical pathology and clinical pathology. You'll hear about some of that from the next speaker. And I would argue that one of the key drivers is recognizing how bad we are in delivering safe, high-quality care. And that's generating demand for informatics solutions. And that's why we're talking about AP now at Lab Infotech 2008. And so this is the relationship that makes sense to me. And I think that organizational alignment is key to getting it right. That if you live too far apart, if you don't share a common vision and mission, if you don't have a common purpose that drives resource allocation, then it's pretty hard to get it right. The second imperative is alignment of tasks. What do I mean by that? I mean a deep common understanding of practice needs and the resolve to respond with innovative and timely solutions. And that's easily said, very difficult to achieve. The way we've taken a run at that at the University of Michigan has to do with the way we're organized around our laboratory operations. Here are our laboratories at the bottom here. The supervisors and lead techs in those laboratories have a direct reporting relationship to chief technologists who report to our dedicated operations administrator, who works closely with me. Our chief technologists have a dotted line reporting relationship to our medical directors. But everybody is engaged in this central group that we call our AP Laboratory Operations Group. Now, that's not because I'm a fan of bureaucracy. Actually, I'm not. But it really has to do with a lean view of how we work. The charge for this group is to provide administrative oversight of laboratory operations, which for us means specimen receiving and accessioning, which also captures our intraoperative frozen section practice. It has to do with cytopathology, histology and immunohistochemistry, electron microscopy, autopsy, and very importantly, AP-related laboratory information systems. And the reason you need a group that provides oversight across that spectrum is because our value stream plows through all of those silos. And we have to make sure that somebody's got the big picture as we're making resource decisions in individual laboratories. Our purpose is to identify and prioritize opportunities for enhancing and improving our performance using lean tools and principles. This is really the group that's driving the adoption of lean thinking in anatomic pathology at the University of Michigan. And two of our most important members are at the top of the list. It's actually an accident of the alphabet. But it's Yul Belice and Kathy Davis, who are from Clinical Informatics, who are regular members at the table almost every Friday morning, this Friday being an exception. This group also includes our laboratory managers, our laboratory directors and physician leadership from not only anatomic pathology but also hematopathology, which organizationally resides elsewhere in our department. It includes members of our administration and it includes some of our trainees. The third imperative, from my perspective, for aligning surgical pathology and informatics is alignment of strategies. So organizational, administrative alignment, alignment of tasks, and alignment of strategy, by which I mean you have to be committed to a common strategic vision and have a shared definition of excellence, meaning we're both going to measure our success using the same metrics. Historically, I've been in places where actually we not only don't have a shared strategy, we have competing strategies, where our success metrics hinge on your failure. And then wonder why it doesn't quite work. So what's our shared strategy? What's our shared strategic vision at the University of Michigan? Our goal is to be top of mind when anyone anywhere imagines excellence in application of clinical informatics to solutions in anatomic pathology. If we can do that, we've both won. And that's our strategy. So that's the principle. What's the experience? And I'm going to share with you the experience in the last 2.5 years because that's as long as I've been at the University of Michigan. So I can't speak to the time before that. We've developed some new tools with specific safety focuses. So that's obviously germane to our conversation. What am I talking about? I'm talking about things like the critical values alerts management report that I talked about last year, and I'm not going to talk about it in detail this year. It's really a tool that daily mines our database to discover cases that look like they might be critical values and look like they haven't been communicated in a way that's consistent with our policy. And we really use that for two things. One is to measure our own compliance with our policy and use those events as educational opportunities. but secondly, for real-time intervention in patient care. If a result hasn't been communicated that should have been, I get on the phone. This is a report that's looked at daily by either me or Dan Vischer, our director of SurgePath, and when something's fallen through the cracks, we feed it back to the practitioner who failed to do the communication in the hope they'll do it better next time, and then we say, do you want to call or should I? Because somebody's going to call. We've also, with Yule's help, developed some unique applications. I'm going to show you one for facilitating case handoff. Now, our practice is a little different from others, at least it was when I arrived, in that cases were not accessioned to people, they were accessioned to services, which is a problem. Because then if something falls through the cracks, you don't know who to call or who to talk to. And when you go to the room where the service lives, most of you just get blank looks, right? So we developed a policy that said, well, we developed several things, one of which is we now have names at computer order entry. But I think more importantly, we had long conversations about communication at a faculty level and created the expectation that if a case changes hands, that can only occur with faculty-to-faculty communication. You can't say to the resident, this case is a pain in the butt. Why don't you take it up to Vischer and have him sign it out, right? Happened all the time before. I don't know how much it happens today. I don't imagine we've eliminated it, but I think we've had an impact. And one of the ways we've done that is using this web-based form that we call an SBARC form. That stands for Situation Background Assessment Recommendation and Calibration. It's really borrowed from the military. This is a communication principle that was developed in the Navy, where handoffs in terms of communication are pretty important, or can be. It's been adopted in some areas of healthcare. It was adopted really in nursing at the University of Michigan, who collaborated with the business school to understand how this might work. And they added the C. The military doesn't have the C. It's just SBAR in the military. And we now use it in pathology. And it's been a pretty effective tool, but we had to have a vehicle to facilitate the communication. That had to be easy. So what we have is a web-based form in which you enter a little bit of text in each of these boxes. Doesn't have to be much, a word or two. You use pull-down menus to send it to the receiving faculty member, and both of you get a copy in your email boxes. And you can print it if you like. We've done some other things in terms of tool development, some of which I'm sure you have at home, barcode-driven electronic order entry for special stains, barcode-driven block labeling, and a unique stalled case management report that's really meant to facilitate flow in the sense that Lean defines flow. That when cases sit still for too long, you're at risk for a variety of reasons. And so this is a report, again, generated daily that identifies cases that have inexplicably stalled at various points, at various checkpoints along the process. So it was gross yesterday, but nothing else has happened. That's out of bounds. What's happening? It's been a very powerful and useful tool to ensure flow in our practice. So those are some of the tools with a specific safety focus that we've built in collaboration with our informatics colleagues. I also want to tell you a story about redesign of our surgical pathology rotations that was implemented in August of 2007. This was really meant to get at safer, higher quality practice. It was meant to get at implementation of some Lean principles in terms of case flow, primarily. This started with a design phase in January of 2007. It went live in August of 2007. And building the tools to facilitate this transition happened at the level of that laboratory operations group that I referenced earlier, so informatics was at the table. And we did a lot of things in anticipation of this pretty dramatic change in our practice, but much of it had to do with creating tools that would support flow. I mentioned that we changed our algorithm to assign faculty at COE, which was not a trivial challenge in our 20-year-old legacy system. I mentioned the stalled case management report. And we also built some important web-based calendars. Now, who hasn't got web-based calendars? No big deal, but they're more than just a place to go to get a name. What I needed was a calendar that sent a message about expectations for team participation, which was a big cultural shift at the University of Michigan in August of 2007. So we now have team-based calendars where you don't learn the name of the attending on a specific service. You learn the name of the attending, the name of the resident, the name of the fellow, and very importantly for us, the name of the PA, who were kind of faceless and nameless in our practice before. And we made the decision that they were going to be key participants in this service transition. And I needed more than the names, I needed a way that made it easy to go from the names to the person. And so this tool allows you to click on any one of these names, immediately come to the window that allows you to do an alphanumeric page. And so it helps you communicate. And so now pretty much every day that I'm on a service, I say to the resident, who's the PA today? And if they can't tell me, we have words. And this is really a tool that speaks to creating a learning environment. It's about developing a working culture in which communication flows freely regardless of authority gradient. Now, our colleagues in informatics were not only key in developing the tools, but they were absolutely key in going live in a way that mattered. Ewell, in fact, was the one, as a member of our operations group, who said, August 1 is a very important day, it ought to look like that. So we bought hats, we had lots of food, we had a war room with lots of information and lots of whiteboards and lots of conversation, and we had a lot of people in that space. And it was really meant to overcome the negative feedback that we anticipated. So we had practitioners, technicians, IT types in this room. Can you recognize the IT types? There they are, Beth Velk and Kathy Davis. Let me back up. Some of you were going to say this guy, weren't you? He looks like an IT type to me. He's a great guy, Chad. He's very bright, very artistic, and he solves a lot of problems for us, and his job is really transportation of specimens. And those are the folks who often have the answers, but you got to get them in the room. Kathy and Beth were key, and of course we had our IT king present. He was probing with others in the room who were generating lots of ideas about what part we got wrong. We didn't really view this deployment as anything other than an experiment, and we knew that our plan, although we'd invested heavily in it, was simply an opportunity to discover what we didn't know about our work. So we said, look, most of this will be wrong, but you gotta help us figure it out, and our informatics colleagues were key. These, by the way, are a couple of surge path types, Matt Wasco and Dave Lucas. IT's been a key participant in lean projects. We're early in our lean journey. We've had two projects, one ongoing, one done, and in its implementation phase. Both teams had participants from our informatics group, and the first team that was tackling accessioning of outside assets and managing outside assets, much of the implementation tasks have in fact fallen to our informatics colleagues. I want to close by showing you some of the other unanticipated opportunities that emerge when surgical pathology and informatics are aligned. This opportunity surfaced in a phone call with a remarkable three-person practice in Venice, Florida. Richard Wisnant, Tammy Densmore, and Bill Roth. Richard trained in Pittsburgh, Tammy and Bill trained at Washington University in St. Louis. They're called Suncoast Pathologists. And they had built an out-of-the-box informatics solution to common problems in pathology practice. This really is the exemplar of what happens when informatics and surgical pathologists live among themselves. And they built very elegant but simple solutions and came to us and said, can we do this in a way that functions at an enterprise level? We now have a relationship and are going forward with that. They developed things like barcode-driven specimen identification and workflow monitoring. So it's not just identification, it's workflow monitoring at grossing, embedding, and cutting stations, and can tell you in real time, just like a flight controller, exactly the status of the operations in their laboratories at any given moment. They built gross descriptions that use template-driven pick lists and free text, and they have a suite of unique tools to improve diagnostic performance while minimizing preventable workflow errors. Things like, again, barcode-driven patient ID and workflow monitoring for the pathologists, not just the technologists. They have some very interesting forced functions that do things like force the person signing out the case to acknowledge certain patient-specific historical data. They have a way of mining for data that might be relevant. They have tools that prevent accidental verification of incomplete cases. And they actually have tools that ensure compliance with QA principles to which they've all agreed, but occasionally, like the rest of us, forget. They have template-driven reporting that's customized by client. They have real-time tracking of diagnostic performance. They can tell, really using rates of concordance as a measure, whether they're getting better, getting worse, or staying the same. And they actually created opportunities to pull relevant knowledge content linked to unique report elements at the time of report verification. Like, did you remember that this is how you grade endometrial cancer? Now, Richard's a pretty techno-savvy guy. But his other two colleagues would not describe themselves in that way. So when we went to Venice to hear about this, I thought, well, I know what I'm going to hear. Richard's going to say it's great, and his two partners are going to say in secret, quiet tones, this really sucks. Right? We're slower now. We miss paper. It's a paperless process. What they said was, oh, my God, our life is so much better. We actually leave work on average 2 hours earlier, having done a better job. Of course, one of the key benefits of working with this group is it's an opportunity to co-develop innovative solutions in a pretty nice place. This is not Ann Arbor. This is Venice, Florida. Well, my purpose this morning was to talk a little bit about the problem of safety in surgical pathology, to talk at a high level, admittedly, about informatics' role in seeking solutions to what's a pretty big problem, and to leave you with what I hope is a positive message, that aligning surgical pathology with informatics resources is absolutely important and a fundamental principle of getting healthcare safe in our environment. And I would claim that our experience to date at the University of Michigan makes the point. Thank you for your attention.